Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Today's the half moon day and beginning of February, so we're running up to Magha Puja, next observance day. In a week's time will be the full moon of February, and this is the annual Magha Puja festival, so I thought I might speak a little bit about that. Offer some reflections on that theme this evening. Magha Puja is one of the three main festival days of the year in the southern Buddhist calendar. So whereas Visakha Puja is the Buddha day, it's a recollection of the birth of the Bodhisattva and the enlightenment, the Buddha's enlightenment, and the parinibbana, the Buddha's final passing away. So those three events all occurred on the full moon day of May. So that is a day particularly to celebrate the Buddha as our teacher, the founder of this religious tradition. Then the full moon of July, Asala Puja, is the day the Buddha gave the first Dhamma teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma. So that is known as the Dhamma day, and particularly recollecting and celebrating the presence of the Dhamma in the world. The Dhamma wheel was set rolling and is still rolling today. Magha Puja is a Sangha day and is a celebration of the quality of spiritual community in particular. Many of you are familiar with the story or the original Magha Puja. So maybe some of you are not, so I'll just share that with you. Oh, the Magha Puja, the full moon of February, was an occasion when there was a spontaneous gathering of 1,250 Arahant disciples of the Buddha. They all came together without any kind of prior arrangement and gathered in the Veluvana, the bamboo grove of in the area of Rajagaha, the city of Rajagaha. And it was a property, was really the first monastery. It was a land that was given to the Buddha by King Bimbisara to be a monastery. And so there, it seems as though there was a spontaneous gathering of 1,250 Arahants. So that might seem very unlikely, but Lumpo Pasanno, who I was co-abbot with for many years in the USA, his pet theory was that the original Magha Puja was probably very shortly after the Buddha's enlightenment and sometime soon after the fire sermon was given, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, because that's as it's recorded in that particular sutta, when the Buddha gave this teaching on the analogy of the six senses being on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion. Sabhang bhikkhave aditang, everything is burning. The world is burning with raga, with passion, with dosa, with aversion, with moha, with delusion. And so all 1,000 of the former fire-worshipping ascetics became arahants hearing that short Dhamma talk. So that was one group of 1,000. And then prior to that, there was other teachings that the Buddha had given shortly after the enlightenment to his original five disciples and to Yasa and his few dozen companions of Yasa. who also all become arahants. And anyway, Lumpur Pasano's pet theory was it was probably shortly after the fire sermon. So there were still 1,000 arahants kind of in the same area. And Gaya Sisa, where the fire sermon was given, isn't too far away from Rajagaha, from the city of Rajagaha. So it was probably the case that there was quite a number of the Buddha's very early disciples all living in the same area. And February being the cold season and the full moon coming up, he said it's quite possible that just it naturally occurred in the minds of a lot of those newly awakened disciples. Oh, it's coming up to the full moon. I've heard news that the Blessed One is staying in Rajagaha. Yeah, let's go and find him there and see if he's offering any teachings. So anyway, that's a pet theory. There's no certainty that that's the case, but it does make a lot of sense why you'd get 1,250 arahants all gathering together without any kind of prior planning, prior agreement. So they gathered together in the bamboo grove, and this was the largest gathering of arahants in the entirety of the Buddha Sasana. So that it's a Sangha day. It's a day to celebrate the Sangha. Firstly, because it was the largest ever gathering of enlightened disciples with the Buddha, but also it was the occasion that he established the very first structure for conduct, for the training rules for the monastic community. So again, that gives the indication that it was very early on in the Buddha's dispensation. So the Ovada Patimokkha, or the way of Patimokkha is the training rules. Ovada is a kind of brief exhortation or words of encouragement. So it's the teaching that the Buddha gave on that occasion was a way of encouraging and establishing the ground rules for conduct within the community. So even though there was 1,250 arahants, they're all enlightened disciples, still he felt inspired or he felt it was necessary, appropriate, to lay down some principles, some basic instructions and a framework for conduct. Which is also interesting. People often will assume that an enlightened being can't do anything wrong or inappropriate, but it's not the case. There was quite a number of the Vinaya rules that we have were established because of the foolish behavior, the misjudgments, or poor choices on behalf of the enlightened ones. And so even the Buddha, some of the Vinaya rules was established because of choices that the Buddha made and realized, oh, that wasn't a very good way to do it. So let's establish a new guideline, like the need for novices to receive the permission of their parents before they go forth. That was because the Buddha's father, King Suddhodana, complained to him that the Buddha had given Rahula the 10 precepts of a novice without consulting the king, without consulting King Suddhodana. So in this Ovada Patimokkha, and then during the next week, we'll chant this a few times, and we'll chant it on the Magga Puja night, as we usually do. The Pali verses and the English translate, two English translations of them are there in the chanting book, so you can look these up. But it starts off with the words Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika Nibbanang Paramang Vadanti Buddha, which means patient endurance is the supreme practice for burning up bad karma or burning up defilements. Nibbana is the supreme realization, has been stated, has been declared by all of the Buddhas. That's how it begins. Ajahn Sujito's translation is is much more poetic, very moving rendering. He says, "Patience is the healing flame." I think it is. Is that right? Cleansing flame. Thank you. Patience is the cleansing flame. Carries the meaning across. So it's talking about being patient. So encouraging, even though they're arahants, he felt the first thing to say was to speak about patience, the paramita of kanti, that quality. So that's worthy of reflection. And then later on in the teaching, he says, anupavado anupagado patimoke ca sangvaro matanyuta ca patasming pantancha sayanasanam. So the not doing of anything harmful, the not hurting, knowing of the right amount when eating food and having a secluded place for resting. Yeah, these are the teachings of the Buddha. So, and again, you'd think this is unlikely to be advice needed for arahants, but it's right there in this first exhortation to the community of the awakened ones. Don't eat too much and don't lie down to sleep in public. Yeah. if you're gonna rest, if you're gonna sleep, find a secluded place to do that, and be mindful when you're eating. Don't eat too much. Matanyuta chapatasming means knowing the right amount when taking food. Also, that can refer to the not necessarily eating too much, but also not eating too little, because he was talking to a lot of former ascetics who would be inclined towards self-mortification, self-starvation, and self-torture. So that knowing the right amount, matanyuta, the right amount, it refers not to just to too much, but also knowing what is too little as well. So having a balanced approach towards the act and the process of eating. So these interesting things to reflect upon. The Buddha establishing these. This is the very first expression of the Vinaya that we have in the teachings, and laying down these basic ground rules: not being violent, not causing harm physically or verbally. Knowing what's appropriate in terms of sleep, in terms of food, and being patient, developing the quality of patience. So if that was advice to arahants, it certainly is good advice for us as individuals. Also, it's the Magga Puja is very much a day to celebrate the quality of Sangha. It was the biggest coming together of arahants, but also in Buddhist countries, particularly in Thailand, Magga Puja has the quality of or the tradition of being a time when people come together, disciples of a particular teacher, come together to pay respects to the teacher, to ask for forgiveness, and to reestablish their quality of commitment to community. So Lumpur Cha would make a lot of this, especially when the number of branch monasteries began to expand. Wat Phananachat was started in 1975, and that was already the 19th branch monastery. And now there's 340 something at the last count. So as the number of branches began to expand, increase, they were popping up like mushrooms in autumn all over Thailand and the West, then Lumpur Cha made a point of encouraging the Sangha to gather together every year on the full moon day of February to make that a particular occasion when they would all gather together. And it was an opportunity to pay respects to him as the teacher for Acharya Puja, but also to strengthen the quality of Sangha itself. Nowadays, after he passed away on the 16th of January, 1992, so then that time for Sangha gathering shifted from the actual full moon of February to the 16th of January, the middle of January, to mark Lumpur's passing away. But it was very much in the spirit of gathering together that Lumpur encouraged, that even if there's not any business to discuss, there's not any kind of reason to travel all the way across the country or to come out of your seclusion other than to go and pay respects to the teacher, he felt that in itself is extraordinarily valuable, coming together and spending time with your companions in the holy life, he saw as being of enormous benefit. And in the list of seven qualities that conduce to the longevity, the long life of the Sangha, number one on the list is as long as the Sangha gathers together, Sangha members meet together frequently and in large numbers, then the Sangha can expect to prosper and not to decline. That's the first one on the list. So Lumpo took that very, very seriously. And so that was an occasion to gather together and to, say, refresh not just the commitment to the Vinaya rules, but also the quality of community, the connections, the friendships, and the relationship with the other Sangha members. It was an opportunity to all gather together into one place for a few days and to, say, reflect upon and to acknowledge and to strengthen the commitment to Sangha itself. This was in the readings that we've been having on a daily basis about Lumpu Cha's biography. Over and over again, the point gets made that he really tried very consciously to cultivate the quality of Sangha. He was a very charismatic, a very impressive and powerful teacher, very knowledgeable, very wise, and very skillful in his teaching. But he was quite determined and consistent in his effort to turn the attention away from himself and to use the opportunity of teaching to encourage people to work together as a Sangha, to see that it was the community itself which was, say, a lasting and powerful presence, not just an impactful teacher or a kind of eloquent or wise individual. He saw what's really going to help, what's going to be of benefit over a long period of time is a Sangha which is mutually supportive, mutually, say, encouraging, and is able to nourish itself, to feed itself, to look after itself over time. Because he'd seen many, many times around him great and powerful, you know, enlightened teachers in Thailand. And once the teacher had passed away, then whoosh, the community all scattered and dissolved. There wasn't much holding it together. So he made a lot of effort to strengthen the quality of Sangha, to have a process of Sangha decision making, to say strengthen that feeling of community by working together and chanting together, and to be very conscious of that a group mentality, a group mind. And the annual gathering of Marga Puja was a particular opportunity for that. The time, February is the cold season, so the weather is still quite pleasant. It's usually dry, it's quite cool, so it's an ideal time to be camping out in the forest, and so it's a naturally pleasant and comfortable time to be gathering together under the shelter of the forest, and not to have to worry about the rain or the heat and so forth. I didn't really have much of a sense of this when I first started out. I arrived in January of 1978, and as many of you probably know the story, I managed to hack a large hole in my foot as a layperson the first week I was at Wat Phananachart. So I had to go to the hospital and was there for a few days. They stitched my foot up, and then I was hobbling around on a stick for a few weeks. And we got to the end of January, and for some reason, I decided to check my passport, and I realized my visa was going to run out in 3 days. I think it was 28th of January, and my visa was going to run out on the 31st. So I went to the Ajahn and said, "Oh, my visa's about to run out. What can I do?" And he said, "Well, you could do two things. We can either give you the eight precepts as an anagarika, as a pakao, and you can You can get permission from the Department of Religious Affairs to stay on here on a religious visa, or you can go to Malaysia and come back in again and get a new tourist visa. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to stay here, so can I take the 8 precepts? And he said, okay, come here at 3 o'clock. So that was my preparation for Anagarika precepts was about 5 hours. I had that conversation about 10 in the morning, so came back at 3, got some whites out of the cupboard from the store monk, took the 8 precepts, and then had to go to Warin Station to get on a train and go to Bangkok. So I was still hobbling around on a stick by the time the full moon of February came around, so I didn't really take in the Magga Puja gathering that year. But then a year later, I was a samanera, a novice, and I was the attendant, the upatak for the Ajahn, for Ajahn Babakaro. And he was going to go over to the main monastery, to Wat Bapong, said, it's Magga Puja tonight, we'll go over to Wat Bapong for the gathering. So I didn't really know what to expect. It was just, a thing's happening at the main monastery. Okay, well, the Ajahn says go, so okay. get my bowl and my robe and get ready to be there in the vehicle on time. But when we went over and gathered together, I was amazed. There's thousands of people. There's the older buildings were still there at that time, but absolutely packed, and then people sitting out in the forest all around the sala. Hundreds of monks and nuns and thousands of lay people also gathered together with the chanting. I never heard anything like it. This sort of wall of sound, like yo so, like this whole sort of a whole body experience. And it was this extraordinary quality of faith and energy that was gathered there. So it was an extraordinary experience. Well, I think particularly strengthened by the fact I had no expectation and no idea what this kind of a gathering was like. And then after the puja, then we did the darkness falls very quickly there. So here, it's dark early in the evening in this time of the year, but there it was it goes from daylight to darkness very quickly. So we arrived in the daylight, but within 45 minutes or an hour, then it was dark. So we all gathered outside and then did the circumambulation. So we had a candle and incense, and there was probably 2,000 or 3,000 people, 3,000 or 4,000 people in this line going around the whole of the central area of Wat Bapong. And this was before there was any electricity there, so the only light is the moon and the candles. And there was just this extraordinary kind of magical quality of just sort of the moonlight shining off the leaves in the forest, and us sort of walking around trying to see our way in the dark, just following the novice in front. But it was an incredible experience for myself as a very sort of young and inexperienced monastic, and this beautiful quality of faith and commitment. And then at the end of we did 3 laps of the whole internal area of the Wat Bapong monastery. And at the end, then everybody put their candles up in the trees. So the candles are burnt down, but people put a few drops of wax on a branch and then pop the candles into the trees. So at the end of the ceremony, then the whole forest is just, you've got this little spots of light all around as the candles burnt out and settled in the trees around the forest. So this was a very, very fond and wonderful memory for me. And then Lumpo Cha gave a rousing Dhamma talk that I couldn't understand a word of. but people were enjoying it very much. And but also Ajahn Prabhakara was extremely skilled in the local dialect, and so he was able to give me a summary of the talk at the end of that. So that's a very inspiring and beautiful quality, a kind of celebration of Sangha, and physically all coming together in one place and expressing devotion to the teacher. But as we know from those of us who live in the community or living here at this time, even if you're here just for a short period as one of the winter retreat support team, the quality of harm of living together or concord or community, it's not just an idea. It's a moment by moment practice. It's an effort to commune, to connect harmoniously with each other. So these kind of ceremonies, puja, where you're all gathering together and there's a quality of ritual, and a formalized sense of togetherness. That's one thing. That's like the amisa puja, or the material offering, or the quality of devotion and dedication expressed in material ways through offering candles and flowers and incense and the circumambulation, walking around three times. But the actual living together harmoniously is another story altogether. That the sangha is not just gathering for a puja, so physically coming together in the same building for an event. You can be physically close to other people and psychologically be 100 miles away. Yeah, we can be completely lost in our own fears and aversions and fantasies. And so physically you're close up to other people wearing the same robes, but mentally you're off on the other side of the planet or off the planet altogether. And so that it's important with these in terms of reflecting on Magga Puja and Sangha, what actually enables us to work together, to live together, what makes us a Sangha rather than just a collection of individuals who happen to live in the same place. That's, I feel, is useful to bring the attention to, and also very close to the heart of Lumpur Cha and what he was trying to teach and the way he lived and what he tried to encourage. And I feel it's also one of the reasons why we have got 340-something branch monasteries around the world, because he was indeed very effective in conveying that spirit to both to talk about it and to encourage it, but also to teach ways that we as human beings can actually commune, how we can live together harmoniously. There's a particular collection of qualities called the Saraniya Dhammas. It's in the Book of the Sixes, I think, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the six Saraniya Dhammas. And these are qualities that conduce to harmony and to concord that the Buddha described. And that he spoke very, very highly of these. So that, in terms of how we work with our lives, our minds, our actions, in order to genuinely cultivate and embody the quality of Sangha, I feel this is these six Saraniya Dhammas are very useful to bring to mind. And as it says in the Sutta, it says these conduce to sympathy, to harmonious and lasting concord. That's the purpose of these qualities, that if they are developed, if they are really brought into being and strengthened and embodied in our lives, they conduce to sympathy, a sense of a connection, being able to relate to the people around you and to have a respectful and sympathetic, empathetic connection with those around us. and that also, and conducing also to a lasting and profound quality of concord and harmony with each other. The first three of these six are all related to each other, and that this maintaining in being acts of loving kindness in the mental world, in our thoughts, in our speech, and in our actions. So maintaining the attitude of loving kindness in thought, in speech, and in action towards your fellow monastics or companions in the holy life, the people that that you live with. So those are the first three, and so the maintaining the thoughts of loving kindness. This is very much to do with attitude. You know, we can't control all the thoughts that arise in the mind, the different emotions and patterns of thinking get triggered and just launch themselves on their own. But what we can do is we can cultivate skillful attitudes. And when we talk about loving kindness, as Lumpo Sumedho would often stress, when it's thoughts of loving kindness, doesn't mean to say that we are trying to make ourselves like everything or like everyone. It's not, metta is not trying to force ourselves to like the unlikable, but rather to cultivate that quality of acceptance, that the sense of everything belongs, that we can be kind even to that which is unlikable or that which is really off-putting or disgusting to us. We can still be kind towards that which is, off-putting or painful or difficult, that they're without any kind of negativity or being hypocritical or deceitful. We're not trying to pretend that we like everybody. Some people we do like. Some people we have no particular feeling towards, and some people we just don't like. We just don't get on with them. We find the mind moving towards criticism or complaint, and often with good reason. That we might find someone's attitude or something about them that we just can't feel comfortable with. So we're not trying to pretend that discomfort is not there. We're not trying to say also with respect to not just the people that we live with, but the world around us, or the feelings of our own body, like having an illness or having an injury. Yeah, we can't pretend that we like having bad knees or a chronic headache or having a chronic back pain or such like. We're not pretending that the bitter is sweet, but rather metta in this respect, having thoughts of loving kindness. It means consciously cultivating an attitude that everything belongs, even if we don't like it or we don't want it. Even if it's harmful, it's part of the way things are. So here it is. We're not pretending that we approve of that. We're not saying that we're glad it's that way. But what we're saying is, here it is. It's this way. So that genuine openness of heart, when we talk about cultivating thoughts of loving kindness, that's is in the area of attitude. So some of these Saraniya Dhammas, some of the six, relate to the attitude or the vijja, the kind of subject side, the awareness side, and others relate more to the charana or the conduct or activity side. So to consciously cultivate the heart of loving kindness, to be working at that attitude of even the people that we like, we feel it's pleasant to be around, then to acknowledge that, but not get lost in that, or not to be developing favoritism, but just a non-possessive quality of benevolence. So metta is a non-possessive love or a non-possessive quality of acceptance. Like, yeah, this person's it's very nice to be around them, they're a good friend, but I don't need to have them nearby. I don't have to have that person around to make me feel comfortable or good. Similarly, if someone is difficult or we don't get on with them, rather than dwelling in the faults that we find, just recognizing, well, this person is really, they have ways of speaking or acting that are really irritating or painful, but that's how they are. I don't particularly like it. I don't condone it, but here it is. It's this way. Just like if you put some bitter tasting food on your tongue, it's bitter. You can't pretend it's sweet, but it's just, this is what bitterness is like. It's this way. So that I feel in terms of my experience in Sangha life over the years I've been living in monasteries, that a conscious cultivation of a radical acceptance, so maintaining thoughts of loving kindness towards your fellows in the holy life and in the world, in our family, that is of great importance, and that's very much in the realm of attitude. Then, in the realm of action, in terms of speech, as the second of the Saranya Dhammas is to maintain in being words of loving kindness, so kindly words, really working to develop speech, not just when you're talking with other people. To be truthful, to be respectful, to be using words that are conducive to concord and such like, with another person, but also the way you talk about other people, the way we describe other people. We can easily make sarcastic remarks, not just about the people that we live with, but politicians or people in society. We can easily get very kind of negative or complaining and be sort of dropping nasty remarks or clever and nasty remarks. The British are very well known for British press is kind of if you're able to make clever and nasty comments, then you often get very highly paid as a journalist. Sorry if there's any journalists here. Often that, though, having a sharp wit and being able to put somebody down in a humorous way, that's, oh yes, very good, impressive. So, to maintain loving kindness in speech is to use words that are honest and helpful, to use speech to unite the divided, to lead towards understanding, towards peacefulness, not using speech to divide or to wound or to create division, or also just that we stir ourselves up with, that we then have to remember having spoken in a harsh or a bitter or a selfish, a greedy or destructive way, or that feeds our own anxiety or feeds other people's anxieties. So to be mindful of speech and to as the Buddha puts it, to cultivate speech which is treasured by the people that we live with. That's always struck me as, oh, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to have our words be treasured by the people that we come in contact with, that we are with thoughtful and careful and discerning about the language we use. And then the third of the Saranya Dhammas is actions, cultivating loving kindness and benevolence in what we do. So essentially being helpful, carrying out the duties that we have around the monastery or in our lives, to be acting in ways that are generous, that are unselfish, that are helpful, that are sort of attuned to the time, the place, the situation, and again choosing actions that are bringing people together, actions that are not creating difficulty or problems for others, or to be, working in the ways that we do to cultivate that which is wholesome, that which is beneficial, so that again, like with Matanyutta, referring to eating, not eating too much, but not eating too little. So similarly, with loving kindness in terms of action, it's both not not trying too hard to sort of fix everything and make everything right, and being anxious and stressing yourself about trying to do too much. Also not being lazy or indifferent or selfish or careless about the things that we do, but learning to work with a quality of balance and knowing that matanyuta, that right amount in terms of action. And going back to speech, similarly with speech, knowing what's the right amount to say. When it's time to say something, say it and talk about it and be ready to speak up if something needs to be said. If nothing needs to be said, then keep quiet. Okay, enough has been said, then leave it there. I'm not very good at that. Yeah, enough has been said. I'm just checking the clock. So. That quality of matanyuta is one of the attributes of a well-rounded being, a sapurisa, and so it applies in speech, in action, and in many many dimensions of our life. And the fourth of the Saranya Dhammas is a readiness to share the things that you have, and in the sutta. The Saranya Dhamma Sutta, the Buddha says, even to sharing the contents of your alms bowl, to be alert to the people that you live with. Have I got something that I could share with somebody else? How much has my friends got? How much has this person got or that person got? Are they going without? Have they got enough woolly socks, or have they got a good umbrella, or you know, how much food are they getting? And as he said, being ready to share even the contents of your alms bowl with those around you, so that you're not keeping a stash for yourself. You're not just persuaded or motivated by that. As long as I've got mine, everything is all right. You know, I've got mine, Jack. You know, what they call the Jack system. I've got mine. You know, don't worry. Don't really care about you. I'm not worried about you. But rather, developing that community consciousness of being ready to share what you have, looking out for the others around you. And that's a way of greatly brightening the heart. The more that the mind dwells upon me and mine, having what I like, what I want for me, and thinking just about my needs and my wishes and my preferences, that's a direct path to depression and loneliness, alienation. I can practically guarantee that's the case for everybody. It's a very, very direct cause for alienation, loneliness. Just the more I'm just concerned about me and don't care about those around, then that is creating these barriers in the heart. And there's acts of sharing, of looking out for others, offering up what we can when we can, and that brings a brightness, a real freedom, a real joy to the heart. As there's one particular place where the Buddha says, even if when you're bowl washing water, if you just you're washing your alms bowl after the meal, and if just the thought as you pour the water with some food scraps in it onto the ground, may some living beings benefit from whatever food, whatever nourishment there is to be gained from this bowl washing water. Yeah, may they be benefited from that. He said, there's punya, there's blessings, there's merit, just even in that thought, that may some beings benefit from this thrown away bowl washing water. There's a punya, there's blessings generated just from that thought. So that's a sharing the things that we have with others, to not be so selfishly guarding our own interests. Then the fifth one is to do with our relationship to the precepts, to using the structure of the the discipline in a very careful and thorough, sincere way, so that this is very much a cause for community harmony. If everyone is keeping to the same standard, if everyone respects the community structures, the precepts that we keep, and the routines that we have, the more that we are sincerely respectful of the precepts, and then the more that we naturally find a sense of communion and connection and relationship to others, so that care, looking after the rules, respecting the precepts as established in this Buddhist tradition that we have, that there's a joyfulness, a delight in say living with people who are like-minded, who have common values, and who are all say working to the same standards. There's a common quality of behavior. As soon as one or two people are not following the same pattern, or they're doing their own thing, then I'm not finding fault with anybody present. I think we have an amazingly good standard of communal respect for the discipline, as far as I can tell, as far as I'm aware. There's a real joyfulness in that. But as soon as one or two people start to sort of do their own thing and go their own way, then it affects everybody. Not only do they get alienated and they have to be defensive and dealing with conflict and criticism, but it sets off resonances in the hearts of all the people around. Oh, what's he going to do now? What did he just do? Oh, he didn't, did he? Oh, all right. The ripples are very immediate. Those kind of effects, the vipaka, the resultant karma of someone not following the discipline in an appropriate and skillful way, that they're not following the standards of the group, because it's demonstrating a kind of disrespect for the group's commitment. And it's also one of the reasons why we gather every 2 weeks to refresh our memory of the rules, and to revive that or make that a centerpiece. And that's why the Buddha established that. That's what we gather together around every 2 weeks. We don't just come together and say Nibbana is the highest happiness. We come together and recite all the training rules, because what holds us together far more than having an idealistic goal of liberation, what really holds us together on the human level is a commitment to a shared standard of behavior, a shared standard of conduct. And so when we wander from that, if I do something that is unskillful or inappropriate, then immediately there's a warning light goes off a little. In the States, they don't have them here, but in the States, they have what they call a rumble strip at the edge of a highway, the motorway, which is a strip of serrated concrete. So if your vehicle drifts off the road, particularly on long straight stretches, so if your vehicle drifts off to the side, then you immediately feel this shuddering in the wheels. It's telling you, oh, you're drifting. So that it's like what they call a rumble strip. So that the vinaya rules are like a rumble strip. They say, oh, wait a minute, that wasn't quite true, or that wasn't quite honest, or that was indulgent, that was inappropriate, or that was unkind. It sets off that kind of shuddering as a warning, like you're drifting off, and if you keep going in that direction, it's going to be a crash. So wake up and get back on the smooth surface. So then the last of the Saraniya Dhammas is again about view and about the attitude or the quality of understanding. It's more in the vijja side of vijja and charana. So vijja means awareness or knowing, so the inner wisdom quality of the Buddha's way. And charana means conduct or action. So the last really is much more to do with the vijja aspect of it, and is the maintaining in being the insight which is noble and liberating, as it says in the sutta. So sustaining that insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta, particularly that recollection, the way of the mind appreciating the nature of reality, the nature of experience, the quality of wisdom that knows all things are in a state of change, all things are unable to satisfy in and of themselves. All things are not self, they're not a person, they don't belong to a person. The insight of the empty nature of the five khandhas, and the more that is sustained, then the more we are able to live harmoniously with each other. If I have a feeling of aversion, if the mind can recognize, well, that's just an empty sankhara. It's just a mental formation arising, passing away. It's not solid. It's not mine. It's not anything real or substantial. Then that wave of aversion can arise, do its thing, and pass away. It's not followed. If there's a feeling of fear, and similarly, the mind can recognize, oh, this is the fear, it's a fear feeling, or there's an experience of attraction. So the mind getting excited by some delicious taste or some favorite food. It knows, oh, that's the feeling of delight or attraction, of greed. So that quality of wisdom, the more that is sustained and informs the attitude that is there moment by moment, even though it's in a way letting go of the personal, letting go of each other, letting go of the personal qualities in a mysterious way, by letting go of each other, by seeing the empty nature of each other, we actually can live together more more harmoniously, more easily. When we take our feelings of like and dislike as solid and real, when we take the stories of he's like this and she's like that, and I like this one, I don't like that one, and this one's inspiring and that one's really worrying, and the more that the mind automatically makes those judgments solid, real, and substantial, permanent, then we find ourselves divided from each other, even if we're really trying hard to help person X or Y or Z, or I really want to help that person. The more there's a me here and a you there, as solid separate entities, then even that compassionate urge to help and to be of benefit can be stressful, can be something that is creating a tension in the heart, a stressing and a tensing in the heart. So that when we look at this or consider this, I feel in a way this is the most challenging but also the most rewarding of these Saraniya Dhammas, that maintaining and being the insight which is noble and liberating, quote unquote, that essentially it's living together and not creating each other. That we are over and over again, moment by moment, recognizing that these personae, these persons, these people, we are all just convenient fictions. The names that we have, the roles that we play, the functions that we have in the community, they are significant. They're to be respected, but they're also empty of any absolute substance. They're convenient fictions, and that when these qualities are recognized as being anicca, dukkha, anatta, when we're able to see each other, other members of the community, the lay community, and the world around us, with that insight, then a profound quality of harmony, that which, as it says in the sutta, is conducive to sympathy and to profound harmony is established. The middle way, I feel, is where these qualities of vijja and charana, of the quality of awareness or knowing, the wisdom side, and the charana, the conduct side, are balanced with each other. You know, the the wisdom side says, you know, everything is empty. there's no person absolutely here. And the Charana side is saying, you know, it's 9:36, you're nearly time to finish the Dhamma talk. the monks sit here, the nuns sit there, the lay people sit there, the men sit on this side, the women sit on that side. That's where we have our balancing act is respecting the conventions that are used, but also seeing that the conventions are empty. And that, as Lumbu Cha famously put it to the young Ajahn Sumedho, when he said, you know, the Dhamma is all about letting go, about seeing everything as empty. The Vinaya is all about holding on. It's all about doing this, not doing that. And when you see how those two fit together, you'll be fine. So to the rational mind, it's like, well, is it either, if it's empty, then it does, there's nothing there, it doesn't matter. Or if it's not empty and it does matter, then there's something there. So which one is it? But I feel what we have in the Buddha's teaching and embodied in the Buddha's life is this wonderful demonstration of, well, the way reality works is that there's both the conventional truth and the ultimate truth that work together. They are in relationship with each other. The vijja, the awareness, the wisdom supports and informs the conduct, the charana, and the charana supports the vijja, the awareness, so that the way that we act, if we speak in a way that is, bringing people together, if we are acting in ways that are unselfish, we share the things that we have, we follow the precepts and the structures very sincerely, very faithfully, then that helps the mind to be clearer. It helps the vijja, the awareness side, harmonious and unselfish action helps to clarify the vision. A clarity of vision helps to purify and free speech and action from greed, hatred, and delusion. So that the charana supports the vijja supports the charana, that these work together. And that what we have in the Buddhist tradition is a very, very finely tuned set of structures, teachings, words, traditions, forms, practices, that they are empty of intrinsic substance, but when they're applied skillfully, they help the mind to awaken to the Dhamma, to the fundamental nature of things. So they are conditions, but they are conditions that help the mind to awaken to the unconditioned. So they need each other, and I feel that the Buddha's insight under the Bodhi tree and what he manifested through his career of teaching was very much how those work together. That he was a totally liberated being, completely incapable of suffering and creating dukkha in his heart, but yet all his action and his speech was perfectly attuned to the time, the place, the situation. As it said, from the time of the enlightenment until the time of the Parinibbana, then every word that the Buddha spoke was appropriate to the time, the place, the situation. Every choice that he made, every action he took was conducive to clarity, to peacefulness, and to liberation. So that when we talk about Sangha and developing Sangha, and the genuine quality of community and strengthening that, enabling that to continue through time, then we need both of these. We need both the vijja side, the awareness, the wisdom side, that which is transcendent, the ultimate truth side, and then there's the conventional truth, the charana, the realm of conduct and action. They need to be equally respected, and when they work together, then that's how the middle way is embodied. That's how the middle way is manifested through this life of ours, moment by moment, and how the Sangha can flourish for the benefit of the individual and the benefit of all beings. So that's exactly 1 hour. I'll leave it there for reflection, contemplation this evening.
Thank you.